Good evening, and welcome to the debut show of Diversity Rules
Love
Magazine
Talk Radio,
celebrating the diversity of our humanity. I am Jim Corey, your host, and the editor-publisher of Diversity Rules Magazine, a niche, subscription-only publication based in upstate New York. Diversity Rules Magazine on the Air is an extension of the print publication. We'll be discussing issues of the day in an informal, at-the-kitchen-table format. No one is right on this show. It is simply an airing of ideas and perspectives. As Aristotle said, it is the mark of an educated mind to entertain a thought without accepting it. While you may hear some things that you will disagree with, all we ask is that you think about what you heard, and more importantly, think for yourselves. If you're interested in finding out more about Diversity Rules, check out the website at www.diversityrulesmagazine.com. There you'll find out how to subscribe, advertise, or just give us money if you want to. We always need that. There are also advertising opportunities for this radio show as well. With all that introductory stuff out of the way, let's move on to our guest. Carrie Ludwig is an author, lecturer, and blogger. She is an eternal spirit having a human existence. She authors the monthly column in Diversity Rules magazine entitled Keep Up Now. She believes in spiritual destiny and manifesting one's own happiness and shaping the lives that we want to have. More importantly, I consider Carrie a dear friend, and I'm honored to have met her and been able to offer her wonderful insight to readers of Diversity Rules magazine. So, Carrie, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Jim.
Cool. Well, welcome. This is exciting. I'm so glad you're my debut guest. I wouldn't have had anybody else.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. I'm so
glad
happy to be here with you today.
Yeah. And I know you have an obligation that you deferred tonight to be on the show, so I appreciate that.
Oh, well, thank you. Actually, it turned out just fine because we have 18 inches of snow here tonight, and my other obligation was canceled.
See, there you go. I ordered the snow.
There you go. See, the universe works in interesting ways.
Good. All right, so why don't we start? Why don't you give us an idea of who Carrie Ludwig is, your background, and, you know, how it's impacted the person you are today? We have a lot to cover tonight, but we'll get through it.
Okay, sounds great. Well, for those of you who are listening and aren't familiar with me, I have two wonderful children. I am a mother, a speaker, a writer, a lecturer, and an interior designer by trade. I've always had an insatiable appetite for spiritual understanding, and I'm very passionate about this experience that we call life. And also, I'm very passionate about sharing the lessons that I've learned to create happiness and abundance in my own life. I grew up in a family with two siblings, a middle-class working parent in the suburbs of a small town in the Northeast. My parents both worked at Singer Link, and my father was an engineer and a designer, and my mother retired to raise her family. I have many happy memories of my early childhood. I recall my mother saying once that I always asked why. I always needed to know why things were the way they were, and if the answer didn't suit me, I just kept on asking. Suppose I was one of those children that was a bit annoying at times. My early years had a huge impact on the direction of my life. My parents separated when I was 6 years old. I remember explosive arguments and objects flying through the air. They did reconcile after 4.5 years, but the day before my father planned to move back to the house, he suffered a heart attack and died immediately.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was it was a time that I remember vividly because I had a dream the night before he died. And in that dream, he told me he was leaving. And
wow.
I woke up the next morning and asked my mother if I could stay home from school the following day. I just felt like something wasn't right and I needed to be home. And that was actually my first recollection of experiencing intuition.
That's quite an experience.
Yeah, it was.
Wow.
My mother, of course, was devastated when she received a phone call from his workplace later that day, and she was trying to explain to me what had happened, but it was if I already knew. I wasn't afraid, and I wasn't even sad. And I just had this feeling that it was natural, that he had already come to me and he had said goodbye. And I had this feeling that, you know, I really needed to help those around me to cope with his death, who were suffering and very much afraid of this thing that we call death. Mm-hmm. So that was actually my first experience with, you know, just the whole death process and what it actually meant to me and what it actually felt like. I remember being at the funeral and kind of playing with his spirit. And I had never had any formal spiritual training before this. And you know, I wasn't raised in a home where people talked about what happened after death. It was, for me, it was just a natural thing. And I was talking to him, you know, not out loud, but in my mind, I was talking to him and he was playing with the lights and making the lights kind of flicker on and off. And
wow.
And I was kind of having fun with that, actually.
That's cool. Huh.
So, yeah, so it was interesting. I don't really have a fear of death right now, probably because of my experience with that particular...
Well, that's good.
That particular experience there. But it was interesting because during my parents' separation when I was younger, my mother had begun drinking, and her grief and her fear over my father's passing just drove her deeper into alcoholism. And at this point, I was about 11 years old, and along with my siblings, we were all basically on our own. Now, my mother was amazing, and you know, she obviously did the best with what she had. And in her sober moments, she was certainly an inspiration. She was incredibly insightful, but the times that she was sober were increasingly rare and not altogether, if not altogether, gone.
That's a tough situation. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a tough situation, but I think when you're living that and you don't know anything else, you don't feel that you're in it. You just do what you need to do to survive.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was apparently, you know, disconnected and realized how desperately she needed help, but I lacked the tools and the insight to help her. So instead, I kind of vowed to put all of that madness behind me, and as most child of alcoholics try to do, at the age of 15, I moved out of my home and into an apartment to just escape from all of it.
Wow, at the age of 15, wow.
The age of 15. But, you know, being on my own, that age, being on my own seemed natural, and it was even freeing since my life had basically been in turmoil since I was 6 years old.
Wow.
And I think really the greatest gift those early years had was having the freedom to make my own choices and make my own mistakes without laying blame on anyone else.
Yeah.
My life was really of my own making, and it was my own. So the early years and the domestication process I went through shaped the choices that I made that created the path that I followed and have journeyed since then. And each path has subsequently been an integral force for shaping the next path.
Well, that's cool.
You seem to have done
okay. So
this seems to be a never-ending quest for truth and a lesson in forgiving and loving oneself.
Now, on your website, you describe yourself as an eternal spirit having a human existence. I'm sort of in tune with that and what that means, but many aren't. So why don't you expand on that and let us know what that means.
Okay. Well, our spirit is eternal, and we've all heard that through different religious formats or domestications that we've been involved in. People say, you know, you're eternal, life is eternal. But you always wonder, well, what does that mean exactly? If we are born and then we die, how are we eternal? If you think about it, the body that we have really is just a tool that allows us to navigate on this plane that we call Earth, much like a computer is a vehicle for the internet or a television is the receiver of the station. The human experience is really an illusion we made of our own creation. Ultimately, it's a manifestation of our belief in separation. In reality, we've never really left our one source, and only when we connect to it do we really feel complete and whole. While we're in the human state...
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I said unfortunately many people don't connect to it. They go through life not awakened, you know, which is sad.
Right. They do or they don't, or they reach a point where they are in a crisis mode usually that that kind of stirs them to ask, you know, why am I here? There must be something more than this. This can't be all there is, and there can't be a God so cruel that all it would do is create all this sadness and unhappiness in our lives, and that forces us to look deeper inside of ourselves for the answer.
Yeah. I was thinking those things when I was in grade school.
right. And, you know,
there's got to be more to life than this darn school, you know? Yeah.
Right. And, it's hard to wrap your head around it. Kind of, I guess, similar to the ancient belief at one point that the world was flat instead of round, but science continues to prove the existence of all types of interesting theories, and now quantum theory and multiple universes. I find it fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's something that I've delved into a lot more in the past 6 months to a year, and I'm amazed at the things I've discovered about myself. Just going within, and within yourself is just an incredible journey that many people don't experience. And I'm glad I turned on, something turned on, and that's where I'm in. I'm inside someplace, but
yeah, that's
I'm not
great.
Sure what it's crazy sometimes. Yeah. Now you say you're a seeker. What do you mean by that?
I think it goes back to I've really spent most of my life searching for the answer, who am I? And I thought everyone asked that question, but apparently that's not the case. I have a sincere desire to discover the truth about who I am and why I'm here, having this human experience, and I'm determined to find out, and I won't stop until I find the answer.
Cool. Well, I'm beginning to think that we may never actually find the complete answer. I think if we find that answer, then it's time to die. You know what I'm saying?
Well, maybe it's time to enjoy it.
Yeah, to enjoy it.
Right.
Yeah, that's true too. Not die. You know what I meant. I didn't mean it that way, but you've fulfilled that mission. So then there's something beyond that learning and point of when you figure out who you are.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I guess we're all seekers in some form or fashion, you know?
I think we all are trying to find happiness. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So now you started writing Keep Up Now for Diversity Rules in 2007 or so. So tell us about the column and why you called it that.
Okay. Well, the column actually is a culmination of some writings that my brother, Rob Ludwig, left to me before he passed away. And for those of you, again, who don't know, my brother, Rob, was born February 23rd, 1966, and he passed in October 21st, 2004. And he was diagnosed with HIV when he was 21 years old and spent the rest of his life basically trying to figure out a way to enjoy the remain of his life and what that actually would look like. And he would write down, he would scribble down some really amazing in-depth messages during what I would call to and refer to as his dark nights of his soul, where he would go into just these states where he would be getting information from the source, from a greater place. And he would write it all down and scribble it all down. And then when he would come out of his state, he would call me and say, well, listen to this, listen to what I read. And he would read it to me. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, this is very similar to what I'm reading in this book. And I was, at the time on my own path, spiritual path and journey, and reading a multiple of different type of spiritual books. And it was interesting because a lot of what he would write was very similar to what I was reading. And before he died, one of our last physical conversations I had with him is he said, you know, keep up now is what's coming into my head. Keep up now. He said he wanted to convey to others the necessity of keeping up or staying in touch with a stream of inner consciousness that we're all connected to. And he felt very strongly that, you know, the writings and the messages that he had written down were going to be important in some way. And he left them for me. And he said, you know, these are for you. And someday you're going to know what to do with it. And I just have faith that this is what I need to do, is give them to you.
Cool. Well, you're with me as long as you want to be with me. I love it.
That's
I love the
good.
Column, and I get a lot of compliments about the column, and you know, it's great, and it's just very insightful, and it's just a different perspective on life that we don't usually get, you know.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
So now you were introduced to me through a mutual acquaintance, who we both have lost touch with. You know, it's an example of thin threads in the universe leading us toward each other, you know, toward people that are supposed to, that we're supposed to meet for whatever reason. So how have these thin threads impacted your life?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I do believe that when you put an intention out there, let's say the spiritual superhighway, people come into your life for certain reasons. And he, sometime after Robbie passed, I was contacted by this person and who was one of his elementary school friends, and he told me he wanted to write an article about Robbie and wanted my approval. And he told me he was involved in this new magazine called Diversity Rules and wanted to share his childhood friendship with my brother.
I remember the article, too.
With people. Yeah, it was a fantastic article, and I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, I felt so great that he, number one, was writing the article, and number two, that he thought enough of me and how I would feel about it to reach out to me first and ask for my blessings before he shared this with the world. And I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. So, I did. I read the article, and I was so excited about it that I gave them.
And I remember the picture too of Chris and Robbie. They were dressed in drag, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. They did it kind of as a joke, you know, when they were younger, and you know, he didn't think much of it. And of course, Robbie hadn't come out yet, so he wasn't really telling anybody. And it was just kind of an interesting photograph taken at the time.
I still have all those old issues, too. One of these days I'm going to dig them out and look through them again and just look at them. And I'm incredulous every time I look at those old ones about how things have changed. And, you know, but it's
right.
It's focus, so.
Right, exactly.
Now, were you done? I didn't want to interrupt you with that
answer.
Well,
no, I was just going to say that, you know, at that time, I thought then I was supposed to give all of his writings to his childhood friend, and this was going to be, you know, this is what I was supposed to do with them, and it just became apparent after several phone calls that maybe this wasn't the path for his writings, and that's when he reached out to me and said, you know what, I think you should be writing this column, and you should be writing this article, and
cool.
That's how it started.
So that's basically when what to do with them occurred to you.
Exactly.
With Chris's article and that whole episode here.
Exactly. It's
amazing how it just clicks, you know? Boom. It's there.
It did, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I wish, you know, you talk about Robbie so much, and he sounded like such a great guy. I probably would have gotten along very well with him.
I'm sure you would.
How did you react to the news that your brother was HIV positive?
Well, you know, back then I didn't really know much about HIV or AIDS at the time. You know, he was just 21 years old. It was back in the early 80s, and when he told me he was HIV positive, you know, in my world, I, you know, wasn't really that connected with the gay community, and I didn't have a lot of gay friends because I, you know, was just wasn't in that particular social group at the time. And so he really was the one that educated me about the disease and told me what to expect. And he basically said he had a death sentence and he had 10 years until it would be full-blown AIDS. And, you know, he basically had this plan mapped out and this was what he was going to do. And matter of fact, and he was going to go live in New York City and create a great life for the next 10 years, and basically, as he was preparing to live, he was also planning to die. So it was, you know,
sad.
It's very sad.
He got infected back in the early 80s when it was just new and vociferous. It was just very...
Right.
It was a death sentence. You know, it wasn't like today.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I told him I would do anything I could to support him, but at that time, I don't think anybody really knew what that meant or what that was until they had gone through it with someone that they loved.
Now, he kept in touch with you? I mean, because a lot of times I hear of things, you know, people when they get HIV, they sort of go within themselves and get reclusive. And did he do that? And did he get in touch with you?
There were times that he did that, but, you know, my brother and I were very close. And, you know, we had an understanding. And maybe it stemmed back to not really having parents. And we, you know, those bonds, I think, they grow a little bit stronger when you've got to rely on each other and, you know, you're kind of dependent on each other and not a parental figure. So we were very close, and he did keep in touch with me, and he lived in New York, and I would go to visit him or he would come up and visit me. And from that point, he moved out to California, and I would go visit him often, or he would come back to New York and visit. And, of course, in between, he would get sick or have, you know, some other types of things occur or happen that we would have to deal with or he was dealing with. And, you know, of course, as we were both dealing with this, our lives were going on. My life was going in a direction. I was raising a family and having children, and he was, you know, building his life and building his careers and building, you know, trying to enjoy his life as much as he could enjoy it. And,
now, did
you know,
have a partner?
He, you know, he actually had several partners, and they were all aware that he had HIV, and, you know, he shared a lot of their struggles with me, and, of course, I had several partners, too, and I shared my struggles with him, and, yeah. And you know, we kind of helped each other get through a lot of the struggles that we had in our relationships.
Cool. Well, that's good. He had his sister to support him, which is nice, you know. A lot of people,
yeah.
I hear also siblings and family abandon people when they find out they have AIDS. You know, it's like, I don't know how you can do it. You know, I would never turn my back on a son or daughter or brother or sister that had it. I just can't imagine the cold,
right.
Callous reaction, like, ugh, I don't want to talk to you anymore. You're sick. You know, it's just very,
yeah.
I just can't fathom it, you know.
I think people are just so full of fear that, you know, that might be their only way to react or respond to it because they're terrified of it.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times, and I've said this a lot, that the worst detractors are people in the gay community. It's incredible. I hate to say that. You know, it sounds bad, but, you know, it is. It's like, you know, it's you think... The community that should understand the issue are the ones that are turning their backs on people too, with, you know, people with AIDS, and it's amazing to me.
Right, and well, if you think about it, fear is fear, no matter who is who it's coming
matter
from.
Who it is or what you are.
Right, and you know, honestly, knowing my brother and seeing his struggles, not only with AIDS and HIV, but even being a gay young man. And there's so many more obstacles and so many more situations that you guys have to deal with than, you know, someone like myself who is not gay or you know, in that situation,
yeah.
Where I would be, I don't know, having to face things that I don't even have to face half the things that you have to face because I'm not gay. And I agree with that. You know, already you've been put through so much torment in your life that, of course, the fear is already there. So it would just make sense that what you said, that people in the gay community would be even more fearful and judgmental because of everything else that they have to go through.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those eternal questions I always ask. It's like
right.
The community that should be very supportive tends not to be sometimes, which really it's irritating, but it's the way it is. You know, like you said, it's based
right.
in fear. So when your brother was diagnosed, the treatments weren't as advanced today. Like treatments today make the disease more manageable than before. But it's still
right.
with us, you know, and people don't understand it's still with us, You know, so what would you say to folks today that think HIV/AIDS has been cured and don't really think about the disease much and think they can just go to the drugstore or to the doctor and get a drug and it'll be fine?
Boy, I'll tell you, my brother was an exceptional young man, and you've seen his pictures and you've heard me talk about him. I mean, not only was he absolutely gorgeous, but he was...
Yeah, he was, actually.
He was physically fit. He was, you know, he was doing commercials with Meredith Baxter Burney in New York. He was,
wow,
you know,
that I didn't realize.
Oh, he could have had it all. I mean, this is one person who literally could have had it all. And, you know, he was cut down in the prime of his life by this disease, and he tried to do whatever he could do to have the best quality of life, and the drugs made him feel terrible. So a lot of his choice was not to take the drugs. Instead, he tried to find a natural path. He tried to work with diet, and he had doctors who were working with him a nutritionist to develop special diets, and he was, you know, taking a lot of homeopathic remedies because he still had a full life. He wanted to live a full life. He still wanted to go snowboarding. He still wanted to play volleyball on the beach, which he was amazing at. And, you know, his body was ridiculous. I mean, he was in amazing shape.
Yeah, it's like I look at his pictures with his shirt off, and I'm like, God damn, I want his body, man. He's almost perfect, you know? It's like, wow.
I know. And that's the life he wanted. And
you get the looks, too. You both have good looks. You're a very attractive woman, too.
Oh, thank you, Jim. I appreciate that. But, you know, he really...
And listeners
he
out there, don't
to...
take that the wrong way. I am gay. I'm not...
it was his desire and his goal to live the best, and and you know, he wasn't okay with just taking the drugs and living the consequences of what the drugs brought.
With any disease, drugs, they're there, but they interact with other things, and they screw up other parts of your body, and you know, it's just...
Exactly.
You listen to the ads on TV with drugs, and it's like, you know, you could die from this. You could have a heart attack. It's like, oh, my God. You know, you're better off not taking the drug.
I know. If you listen to half of that, it's terrible.
Jeez. So how did he deal? You already touched on it, but how did he deal with the challenges of HIV/AIDS? And did he have a good support network? And how did he deal with this social stigma?
Well, you know.
Was in the middle of.
Yeah, he had really good doctors, and he had, like I said, a team of doctors and nutritionists, and he actually had some great friends that he played volleyball with. So he had a good core group of friends that were there for him, you know, during the volleyball, and that was great for him. And of course, he and I shared a lot of information, and we were a support network for each other, but you know, in the end, AIDS is a lonely battle. You know, it's a tough thing because it keeps you really from having those close relationships with a partner, with a loving relationship partner. And you know, in the end, the paradox was that it brought him the greatest lesson in life. You know, at one point, my brother said to me, "I know why I chose to have AIDS this time around." At him, I said, "Oh my gosh, really?" And he said, "Yeah." He goes, I really think that I chose this life, as horrible and debilitating as it is. I think this was my choice because it was the only thing that would keep me away from trying to have and learn about love with another person in a special relationship." He said, "The truth is, everything you need is inside of you, and you have to look down inside of you to find that love." And he said, AIDS is the one thing that kept me away from having that kind of relationship with somebody else and kept turning me inward and to find and search inside of myself.
Oh, there is, you know, there is something good that comes from everything bad, you know.
He
looked inside himself and he found answers and he became comfortable with what was happening with him and he found his answers, you know.
That's true. That's very true. Very true.
Yeah. So you were very close to Robbie, obviously. as in life, and, you know, you had a connection to him spiritually, and you have a connection to him spiritually now that he's crossed over. So when do you feel his presence the most? How do you know he's with you?
Well, that's a good question, because a lot of people ask me that, especially when they're dealing with the death of a loved one or a partner or a sibling, and this is what I try to explain. When you lose somebody, in your mind you feel that you've lost them because their vehicle is no longer in their consciousness, and their spirit is no longer in their vehicle. But the truth is, their consciousness and their spirit is available to you at any moment. But when you're missing them and you're grieving their death and you're feeling alone, you're actually pushing them away from you, because you're pushing that spirit away from you. You're not accepting it. The moment you invite that back in is the moment that they're with you.
Hmm.
And so when I want my brother with me, all I say is, be here now. And he just jumps right back.
And he's there. That's cool.
And he's there. And I can feel it. And it just gives me a sense of, it's almost like empowerment. I just feel this strong consciousness, this strong being with him, with the strong being that I know is him, just because of the familiarity. And I can just feel him with me. And there's times when I've had to face something on my own, or I've had to go into an unfamiliar situation with work or with a personal matter, and I've been really nervous about it, and I've stopped for a minute, and I said, oh, I can bring Robbie with me. And I'll just say, be here now. And, boy, I'll tell you, I can feel it. I really can feel it. And he does visit me in dreams, and, you know, there's been a couple of times. I remember just after he passed, a couple of months after he passed, I was really missing him, and I think it was because he was so far away when he passed, and I wasn't able to be with him, and I missed that final physical goodbye. I mean, I knew that he was with me still, but I missed that feeling of closure. And I had a dream, and in my dream, he came across the top of this hill, and I can still remember it like it was just last night. He came across the top of this hill with a horse on a lead, and he was walking. And, you know, as we discussed, he's got this amazing body. So he basically has this, like, I don't even know, like a loincloth or something. And he had this just gorgeous tanned body that, you know, being on the beach in Southern California will always give you. So he came to me looking just absolutely amazing. And he had this horse on a lead and this big smile on his face. And he just had this infectious smile. And he came up to me and he handed me the lead of the horse, because I always wanted a horse. And these were parts of the dreams that I didn't even put together until after I dissected the dream, because in my dream, all I wanted to do was hug him. So the fact that he was handing me this lead of a horse, I didn't even acknowledge it in the dream. I just went right to him. I wrapped my arms around him. He wrapped his arms around me. And I just said, I love you, and I miss you so much. And he was holding me, and I was sobbing. Every bit of him holding me, because he used to give these giant bear hugs.
I could
just feel his arms around me, just giving me this great big bear hug. And I was literally sobbing with joy. And I woke up sobbing with joy. And I remember thinking, oh, God, he was giving me a horse, and I didn't even acknowledge it.
that's great. That's definitely an episode of presence. Yeah.
And he's come to me a couple of times with other things, kind of giving me odd looks, like, "What are you doing? Why are you not doing what you're supposed to be doing?"
Yeah. I know when I summon spirit guides and those that I rely on, I feel like I am right now. The room is warm, but I have goosebumps. You know, it's like I know somebody's with me when I feel those goosebumps, you know?
Right. It's a confirmation.
They come to us in any which way, and the one that we relate to the most, I guess, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So now,
true.
Writing Keep Up Now has led to other projects, such as writing a book. So what's the book about, and when is it going to be on the New York Times bestseller list?
Wow. My book is a culmination of the lessons I have learned on my journey. And my goal is to have it completed this spring and hopefully on the bestseller list this fall.
Cool. So we'll look for it.
Very excited.
I want an autographed copy.
You've got it. You'll get the first one.
All right. That's good. Well, I'll promote it. I'll do what I can to help you get it out there.
Well,
so.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate that.
I said you. I don't see you that often, but I feel like I know Robbie because of your writings. Because every time I get the article, I read his quote, and I'm like, man, you know, that's great. He's the guy. I would have loved to have sat across the kitchen table with him and just chatted. You know, it would have been awesome.
Yeah, really amazing. Yeah. And you know, his story is a whole another story that I'd love to get into sometime with you because it's a pretty amazing story.
Come back. We'll have you back on. Yeah.
Sounds great.
So, you've been a lecturer, too, for many years, and you also facilitate a course on miracles. So, what is that course all about, and how would one get enrolled in that?
Well, A Course in Miracles is really a self-study spiritual thought system. And it's not necessarily something you need to get enrolled in. It's actually a book. It's a curriculum.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And it consists of a text and a workbook for students and a manual for teachers. So the beginning of the book is a text, and the middle of the book is where the workbook lessons are. There is one through 365, one for every day of the year. And the manual for teachers is really interesting, and it gets more into the dynamics of what the text and the workbook are for.
Mm.
It ultimately teaches the way to universal love and peace by undoing guilt through forgiving others.
Hmm. And this is the course you would have been at tonight if you weren't here and if it wasn't canceled because of the snowstorm, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I facilitate my study group every Wednesday. And actually, I was reading the Course in Miracles book for 4 years before I even knew there was a study group that facilitated it. And some people don't do study groups. They don't prefer to do study groups. And it's like I said before, it's not necessary. And there's a lot of online support for A Course in Miracles as well. And there's chapters all over the world. It really is worldwide if you're looking at getting involved in a Course in Miracles study group. And you know, a lot of people are Course in Miracles students, like Marianne Williamson and Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer, just to name a few, and a lot of their work is based on A Course in Miracles.
I find, you know, study groups are helpful. It just verifies and affirms that there are other people out there that believe in the same thing, and, you know, they're on a journey, and you're with them on this journey at their level, and it's just cool knowing that, you know, there are people out there that you can fall back on. And that's true, and sometimes it's nice to...
The course can be interesting reading and sometimes difficult reading. And if you're talking about it in a group, sometimes it makes it a little more clear and people can kind of share their experiences and what the course, how the course has influenced their experiences. And it really does help.
Yeah, because I know there's a group here that I've started going to. I haven't gone the past couple months, but I have to get back at it. Mind, Body, Spirit Collective.
Great.
And,
I didn't realize that. Good
yeah,
for you.
And I just love all these people that go to this thing. It's great because, you know, I've dabbled in this reconnected healing. I've gotten into meditation and past life regression. And there's even a dog whisperer there who gave me insight on my dog and my mom and dad's dog. So it was like, oh my God, there's so many people like this out there. That's cool.
That's very interesting. That is very interesting. Actually, I had a gentleman who lives up by you, who is coming to my group every Wednesday.
Ah, cool.
For a while, so that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, now, unfortunately, I can't come to your group because I'll be doing this radio show every Wednesday.
I know, but it's so exciting.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. I've always wanted to do this, so this is totally cool. So now, we have to touch on this topic here, organized religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a favorite topic. You know, it's something that will always be with us. You know, but many experience a spiritual awakening that goes beyond that man-made religion and all the preconceived notions that go along with it and all the dogma and all that crap. So, you know, what influence do you see this personal awakening having, and can it change the world for the better outside of this organized religion realm that's driven into our heads when we're little kids?
Right, right. Well, I think all of us have been domesticated in one fashion or another. And, you know, we're all on this journey, and all that's really necessary to change the world is to change your own mind. Because when you change your own mind, then the world you see will change.
Yeah. Yeah, the mind is a powerful tool. People don't realize it. And I even have to catch myself because, you know, I'm in this transition period. I left my job after 21 years and, you know, things are a little precarious and on the edge right now. And, I get enmeshed in fear and angst, and I'm like, how am I going to pay this? How am I going to do that? And you know, you got to ground yourself and just believe in yourself and that things will come when you need them, you know?
Right. You have to have faith and you have to do the work to put it out there. You know, the other thing I want to say about organized religion, too, is that, you know, there are many paths, but they all lead to the same place. And, you know, just because someone's on a path that you're not on doesn't make their path wrong and your path right or vice versa.
Yeah.
Right. It's, you know, it's one of those things that we're all exactly where we need to be at every moment. And there's sometimes when we've learned lessons that other people haven't learned, and you look at them and you think, oh, my gosh, if I could just keep you from that, if I could just help you to avoid that. But in the end, you can't. You have to allow them to walk their own path, and sometimes that's the hardest thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, that's what you have to think about when you're experiencing stuff like we do. It's like, you know, I'm here for a reason. I'm experiencing all this bullshit for a reason. And it's like, all right, I got to deal with it.
Right. That's true.
Gosh. Yeah. You've undertaken an intense examination of yourself. You've become very in tune to the idea of, you know, spiritual destiny and unseen forces that influence our lives. So why do you think this self-reflection is important? Why should we all do it?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm a seeker, and it's my path and my desire to create happiness in my life experience. And I've just realized myself that if I want to do that, I need to go inside and find the answers that I'm seeking for. Like I mentioned before, you know, it's important to remember that everyone has their own path and that they're exactly where they're supposed to be. So, you know, self-reflection is important for me, but it might not necessarily be important for somebody else. And it's important for me to remember that that's their path.
It's a growth period, and, you know, you have to find your own. Because it was interesting because a few years back, I see a spiritualist. I've been seeing this woman for, like, years and years and years now, and she told me, once in a reading, she says, you're gonna explore yourself in an intense way that you've never experienced before. And at the time, I had no clue what she was talking about, you know. But now I've experienced it, and I'm like, ah, that's what she was talking about. Reconnected healing, meditation, you know, past life regression and all this stuff. It's like things I would never have thought about before. You get these things when you're ready to do them. And they all, you know, the people came in front of me when I was ready to do it. And if you ever get a chance, you should have an Akashic reading done. It's an incredible, phenomenal thing. It basically is an analysis of your past life in the cosmic library, so to speak. You know, this person
has
this library and this is Jim Corey, this is Terry Ludwig, and there you are, you know? And it's incredible.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That sounds great. Well, they always say, when the student is ready, the teacher will come.
Exactly. So, I see we have a caller. Do we have a caller? I wonder if we should take that call.
Sure.
Well, the producer probably is screening them, so let's go to this question first.
Okay.
Give us some examples of... when help has come from the other side, when you asked for it, how did you know it was the answer you were seeking?
Well, I've learned over the years to ask for help quite frequently. I used to be the type of person that had to figure it out myself, and I thought that all of the answers had to come from me. And I've learned now that you really need to ask for help and connect yourself to that source. But I have to say, you know, there was one time when I really did ask specifically for an answer. And I asked my mother this question, and she was undergoing cancer radiation chemotherapy, and they had given her, you know, only a few months to live. And I said, you know, if it doesn't interrupt your path and your journey, and you can come back and tell me, you know, what is the most profound thing that I should know on this human experience to gain the most out of this experience. If you could come back and tell me that, I told her, I said, I promise I won't be afraid, and I promise that, you know, I'll listen to you. Mm-hmm. And she passed away, and several months later, I was having this dream. I actually forgot that, you know, we'd had this conversation, and she did say that she would come back and give me this message. And she said, while she was still living, she said to me that, you know, I said, what do you think it's going to be like when you die? And she said, well, I already know what it's going to be like. And I said, well, how do you know? She said, well, you were there. You remember.
Oh, wow.
And I recall the time when I had found her lying in her bed. I hadn't talked to her for a few days, and I found her in her bed, and she was cold to the touch. And I thought, oh, my God, I think she's dead. And
wow.
I didn't quite know how to react, and I kind of walked away for a minute or so, and something inside of me just took over, and I jumped up on top of her, and I started shaking her shoulders, and I said, Mom, Mom, and there was nothing. There was no response, and I bent down to see if I could feel breathing or anything coming, and I couldn't really feel any breath or sense any pulse, and I shook her again. I said, Mom, and all of a sudden her eyes opened. And I thought, oh, wow. My God, is that a reaction? Is that just a nerve? Like, what is that? And after, you know, a couple more shakes, she started just trying to.
Oh, are you there? Uh-oh, what happened?
Oh, and I kind of dropped it at that moment. And then she recalled this to me, and she said, you remember that time that you called me back? And I said, well, yeah, but I didn't, at the time, I thought you had died, but I didn't know because you woke up. And she said, no, I was there. She said, I was bathed in this beautiful, beautiful light, and I had this most loving experience. She said, and then I heard you calling me, and I knew I had to come back. And that was amazing. But this is when I asked her, I said, well, if you can come back again after you cross over in some way to just let me know what the most profound thing is that I should know about this experience, that would be great. So she did. She came back again in a dream I was having, just some random dream, and I heard her voice calling me, and all of a sudden I stopped in the middle of this dream and turned around, and I was transported back in the house I grew up in, and she was calling
me,
and I thought, oh, my God, she did it. She came back.
Huh.
So I turned around, and it was an amazing, amazing experience. And I turned around, and I was in my bedroom, and I went down the hall and ran down the stairs, skipping everyone like I did when I was younger. And there she was, just beautiful, laying on the couch that I always saw her basically passed out on when she was drunk. But now she was just absolutely beautiful. Her hair was stunning, and she had this brilliant smile on her face, and I knew at that moment that she was going to tell me something really profound, and I had to remember it, and I wouldn't be able to write it down. So I looked around and grabbed a chair and pulled up and sat down and put my elbows on my knees in my dream. I remember all of this, and I clasped my hands together and looked at her, and I said, okay, I'm ready. What is it? And she looked at me, and she just smiled, and telepathically, she gave this kind of a giggle that a mother gives when her child is asking her a really silly question. And she gave this giggle, and what she said to me was, don't look outside of yourself for the answers. Everything you need to know is inside of you.
Wow.
And
that's
that was
your
it.
Profound answer. Yeah.
That was it. That was the most profound thing that she could tell me in this human experience. And it's
usually
been proven.
The simplest, yeah. It's
yeah.
Incredible. It's
time
usually
and time
the simplest
again.
Thing that you have the hardest time finding, you know?
Right. Because you're looking
but
everywhere else.
We have a caller, and they want to call. They want to talk to you. So
okay.
The producer is saying they have a caller for us. So let's bring them on. Caller, are you there?
I am.
Ooh. Caller, who are you? And what
this
would you
is
like to ask
David.
David.
This is David.
How are you?
Hi, Terry. I'm good. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. I had a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
One was you were talking about the many pathways to God, and I believe that to be true. What I'm wondering is it possible to dialogue with somebody who says something like, unless you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you're going to go to hell?
Well, are you asking me if you can have a conversation with them?
Around that.
Well, I think that person has been domesticated to believe that that is true.
Yes.
And I don't know if you are actually going to have a meaningful conversation if it's your intention to change their mind. I think people have to come to their own conclusion about what they feel life is and what they feel God is.
I just wondered if it's possible to plant any seeds.
Well, I would say probably the most effective thing to do with a person or any situation like that is to just be love, because the truth is you are love. And if you can just offer that person love and support in spite of what their belief is and not let it affect you and your beliefs, that's the most loving thing you can do. And then you can show that person that you are one with God.
I imagine the same approach would need to be taken with an atheist.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I had an interesting conversation with someone who was a self-proclaimed atheist. And they said, I don't believe in God. And I said, well, I don't believe in the God that most people believe in either. I guess the question is, what God are you not believing in?
Yeah.
Right. Well,
yeah,
I was interested.
You know, a lot of people, they see this and they hear these different things, and a lot of people are so entrenched in what they believe. They're afraid to open their minds to these other things that we've been talking about tonight and that you just brought up, David.
I was interested that you're a student and teacher of the Course in Miracles. I have been studying the Course myself. It's been dormant for a while, but it really has expanded my mind. I found the text very difficult. I think that the workbook for teachers is much more clear. What do you think?
I totally agree with you. Actually, when I started reading A Course in Miracles, I started reading the text, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I am never going to get through this. And so I leaped through the lessons, and then I went directly to the manual for teachers, and I started reading that. And that was so inspiring to me that I thought, oh, my gosh, if this is what this book is going to teach me, I have got to read the text no matter how difficult it is. So reading the manual for teachers was my inspiration for actually digging my feet into the text and getting through the text. So absolutely, that was, I feel the same way.
For somebody that is new to the course, would you recommend they read the manual for teachers first?
Well, the first thing you should read, anybody should read, is the beginning of the course before the text actually starts, how it came. I think that's important to read.
Yes.
And then I would start reading the text, and if you can do it with, like, as Jim said, sometimes it's easier to do it with somebody, and maybe somebody who's been through it a few times. I've actually read the entire book 5 times.
Wow.
And I will probably continue to read it for the rest of my life. I remember the first time I completed it the first time, and I thought, that's it. I have all the answers. I'm going to create a great life, and this is going to be awesome. And it soon became very clear that the moment you think you know is the moment you don't know.
Well, one final question. I believe that everything happens for a reason. Do you believe that too?
Absolutely.
Now, with that in mind, I heard you talking earlier, and I'm sorry I didn't catch all of it, but it sounds like you came from an alcoholic home.
Yes.
Have you been able to piece together the reason for that as part of your own pathway? I'm a recovering alcoholic myself and a recovering sex addict, and I used to bemoan the addictions and look at them as bad things, and I've come to realize that judging them was not a healthy thing to do, and that it actually has been part of my journey, which has brought me to a place where I can be more compassionate, where I have something to share with others who are walking a similar path and be of help to them. And I think that coming from an alcoholic home or a dysfunctional home, which many people come from, there are just so many scars that are there that need to be healed. And I think it would be helpful to people out there who have come from abusive family situations, alcoholic situations, or extreme dysfunction like mental illness in parents, to let them know that there is help and that there is some sort of reason that may be a mystery to them. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure, sure. I do believe that because of what I experienced, it actually helped me to discover more about myself and ask those deeper questions. And I think that, you know, if I had been born into a different situation and maybe are not as much conflict, I probably would never have asked those questions because I wouldn't have been put in a situation where I would have to dig deeper into myself. And for me, this choice in my life, I'm here to find out why. I want to know why. And before I was, as I said, before my parents started separating and before the house became an alcoholic house after my father's death, it was a very happy home. And, you know, there really, it was, you know, your basic middle-class family and mother, father, and kids. And I think just my incessant questioning of why, I don't think I would have gotten those answers if I hadn't been forced to look. If I hadn't been forced to look inside, just like my brother said.
I hate to interrupt you, but we are at the two-minute warning here. So
okay.
If you could wrap up the question, and then we can end the show here and end
great.
On time.
Thank you.
Say,
I appreciate your answer.
Sure.
God bless.
God bless.
Awesome.
Nice talking to you, David.
You too.
But yeah, thanks, David. David
You're
is
welcome.
The owner of the network that Diversity Rules magazine on the air is part of, and David's a great guy, and I'm so grateful that he's allowed me to do this show under his mantra or his banner here. So
that's fantastic.
So anyway, we are down to 1 minute, and I want to thank you so much for coming on. I definitely will have you back.
Thank
you,
Jim. It was
about.
A pleasure. I really enjoyed it. I really did. It was fantastic.
Great. All right. So I'll be talking to you soon and start writing your next column.
Okay, I will. Thank
so
you.
So there
Jim.
You have it. Our show is almost complete, and I just want to tell you about next week's guest. She is the February feature interviewee in the publication, Barb Morrison. She identifies as a bisexual, is an American recording artist, top 5 Billboard dance chart songwriter, and gold record producer. She's best known as a producer for numerous artists such as Blondie, Rufus Wainwright, LP, and was part of a production duo, Super Buddha. And you won't want to miss this show. So it's time to bid adieu until next week. And I just want to tell you, just keep on forging ahead with your lives and live your destinies to the fullest.
Yeah. You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks to find common ground and take it to the next level here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com. Welcome to Diversity Rules Magazine. We hope you have enjoyed your brief sojourn here with Diversity Rules Magazine on the air. We, alas, must part paths until next week, when we will begin a new journey into your mind and discuss compelling issues of the day, touching on diversity and acceptance. The world is a beautifully diverse place with many perspectives, and it is our hope you took away something from tonight's show that enhanced and strengthened your resolve to make the world a better place for all its inhabitants.